Today, Loretta Napoleoni, author of The Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. After interviewing former members of armed groups, she offers a unique insight into the management of these armed organizations. Today, she will unveil to us a shocking new phenomenon, the economies of terrorism.
Welcome to the Vancouver Public Library. My name is Janice Douglas, and I'm the program director. Tonight, you came to hear Loretta Napoleoni, expert on terrorism. Who is this person that she could actually write a book about this subject? Loretta Napoleoni was born in Rome. In the mid-1970s, she became an active member of the feminist movement and a political activist. She was a Fulbright Scholar at Johns Hopkins University and a Rotary Scholar at the London School of Economics. As an economist, she's worked for several banks and international organizations in Europe and the United States. She is also a journalist and has worked as a foreign correspondent for several Italian financial papers. She's also written novels, guidebooks in Italian, and translated and edited books on terrorism. Her most recent novel, Dossier Baghdad, is a financial thriller set during the Gulf War. She is among the few people to interview the Red Brigades in Italy after three decades of silence, and this topic was the basis of her PhD. She is an expert on terrorism. Please welcome Loretta Napoleoni.
Thank you very much. I'm going to tell you the story of the making of this book, which I think is very illuminating, about how little do we know about terrorism even today. And then I'll summarize very briefly the concept of the new economy of terror, and then I'll open it to discussion. I started researching terrorism 10 years ago. At that time, I was working for a bank. I was living in London. I just had a baby, who is actually sitting here in the front row. And the last thing at that time I really wanted to do was to go back to Italy and research terrorism. The reason why I did it is because I received a phone call from a friend of mine. At that time he was working for an organization that looked after the rights of political prisoners in Italian jails. And he called me and he asked me if I was interested in interviewing the Red Brigades. Now, the Red Brigades was the Italian Marxist terrorist group which was very active in Italy from the 1960s to the late 1980s. They, as a strategy in their armed struggle against the state, they did not speak with anybody for 30 years. In fact, they sat through their trials in silence. Now, this is a strategy that often armed organizations follow in order to carry on their armed struggle even after they've been arrested. An example of this strategy is Zakaria Massawi, the 20, or alleged 20 hijacker of 9/11, who is on trial in the United States and has refused to accept the authority of the United States to put him on trial. So the Red Brigades, basically, they sealed themselves in a wall of silence for 30 years. The first question I asked my friend was, you know, why the Red Brigades want to talk to me? He said that they wanted to talk to me because I was an economist, I was living abroad, I had no links with any political parties in Italy. So they thought I was going to do a fairly good job in telling the world their story. Also, as a founder of the Italian feminist movement, I had met a lot of female members of the Red Brigades, although I did not know at that time that they were also members of the Red Brigades. So the female members of the Red Brigades had suggested my name. But the most important reason why they came to me is because my childhood friend, she had become a leader of the Red Brigades. And again, I discovered it the day I opened the newspaper and I read that she had been arrested. I must confess that I accepted to interview the Red Brigades for two reasons. which are very personal reasons. One, I wanted to understand why my childhood friend had become a terrorist. I wanted to understand what made her embrace political violence and kill people. And then I wanted to know why she had never tried to recruit me. So I decided to go back to university. I went back to the London School of Economics because I convinced the professor that I was going to do a PhD on the Italian Red Brigades. I even got some money from the university to do my research. And I went back to Italy. I spent 3 years interviewing members, not only of the Red Brigades, but also of various left and right-wing organizations. And I found the answer to my question very quickly. My friend had embraced political violence because she believed that that was the only way to break a situation which is defined in political science of a bloc democracy. Italy was a democracy, but in reality was ruled by one party for 35 years. And therefore, she believed that the only way to free the country from that condition was actually to use violence. The answer to the second question was even more interesting because I was not recruited because I failed the psychological profile. I failed every single one of the items in that profile. I was too strong-minded, too opinionated. I was judged as somebody that would only create troubles for the organization. So this is why it never came to me. Now, you must understand that the Red Brigades, as any other armed organization, is extremely hierarchical. People that join in, they join in because they want to follow orders. In order to become a leader of the Red Brigades, it takes decades. I mean, it's very pyramidal. Therefore, I was not really the right person. Now, there is something about the Red Brigades, the women's were actually, I'm not saying that they were discriminated against, but it was much, much harder for a woman to get to the top of the organization. Only two women succeeded. One was my friend. And the reason why they succeeded, I think, is because they were extremely ruthless. Now, there is something about being ruthless in this organization that almost creates a sort of charisma around the person. People start fearing you, thinking that for you it's easier to kill, because for every single one of these people, killing is extremely difficult. But that's the same thing in the right-wing groups I interviewed. What was particularly interesting is the fact that when they did the profiling for recruiting, they didn't really look at your political ideas. They looked at your personality. Personality was key, because then once you got into the organization, they would mold you to whatever ideology the leadership wanted you to follow. Because the truth is that the political line and the ideology was decided by a group of, you know, 3 to 5 people. All the others simply follow. And this is when I discovered that the life of a terrorist is actually not ruled by politics, it is ruled by economics. Apart from these 3 to 4 people who actually spend their life, you know, writing various documents, deciding, you know, which line the organization has to follow, all the rest of the members of the organization search for money. They were constantly short of money. They needed money to rent safe houses, to buy weapons, to carry out, you know, new attacks. Their life rotated around, you know, raising money. And this is when I thought, this is extremely interesting, because nobody had ever even mentioned the financial dimension of a terrorist organization. Now, it is possible that I came to this conclusion also because I am an economist, so I'm trained to think in a certain way. I'm not a political scientist, so I was not really searching for the ideology so much as I was searching, you know, for something different. But anyway, when I discovered this, I started asking them questions about, you know, how do you actually write in money? And they were very happy to talk to me because they were extremely proud of the way they generated cash. So I remember one story which was quite interesting. It was told by a former psychiatrist. He was a member of the organization, and he was a keen sailor. He had a beautiful sailing boat, and what he did during the summer months was sailing from Italy to Lebanon to pick up weapons from the PLO, load the boat of weapons, and then sail back to Sardinia. Sardinia is an island offshore the west coast of Italy. And then in Sardinia, the various Marxist terrorist organizations from Europe would go and pick up their share of the weapons. For that service, the Red Brigades got a fee, which went to fund the organization. I mean, this is just one of the many stories I was told. And at that point, I thought, I really or to research this topic. So I tried to do the impossible. I tried to change the topic of my PhD, which is never works, of course. So I then went to university, to foundation, trying to raise money for the research, and everybody thought that was a bit odd. Everybody thought, you know, what is this woman talking about? The economics of terrorism. I even went to my literary agent and I asked her if she could get me a contract with a publisher. And my literary agent said, this is in 1996. She said, why do you want to do this? Terrorism is a dead subject. The truth is that terrorism in 1996 was a dead subject. There were no more than 20 people in the world who were working on terrorism. There were no funds available. There was really nothing in terms of research. I carried on my research by myself, actually. I managed to get some funds, and also I was working with a professor from one of the universities in England. So together we managed, you know, to get some funds. Anyway, in 2000, I approached a literary agency in New York because I was watching very closely the development of Islamic terror, and I thought that they were clearly targeting American interests in the Middle East. So I thought in the US possibly there is more interest than in Italy. I got exactly the same answer. I mean, they were very polite, but you know, they said no thank you. I mean, there is no interest in terrorists in America. Then on September 12, 2001, my phone never stopped ringing because all of these people wanted my book, they wanted my research, and of course none of them had funded it. So the literary agency asked me to put out a proposal for a book, which I did in a month. Of course, you know, I had a vast archive, and I mean, I knew quite a lot about the topic. So the proposal went out to 24 top publishers in the US. 18 commissioning editors immediately wanted to buy the book. So the agency, of course, was after the money because this is commercial publishers, decided to go to auction. And one by one, the commissioning editors dropped out of the auction. The reason is that the board of directors of these various publishing companies had vetoed the book. I was not surprised, but the agency was shocked. Now, why did they do that? The initial reasons were very superficial, ranging from in 6 months terrorism is not going to be a problem anymore, to how are we going to market a book about a phenomenon that does not exist. Okay. But the real reason, of course, were told to us later by the commissioning editors, who, of course, you know, were extremely embarrassed about what had happened. The reason why the book was vetoed is because I was presenting terrorism as an international economic system where there are charities, bank, businessmen, a system which had been in place for 50 years. An economy that was, you know, a real giant. And at that time, what editors, newspapers, politicians, the people wanted to hear was that 9/11 was the result of the action of a bunch of religious fanatics living in the caves of Afghanistan. That's what the world wanted to know. It was too early for a different analysis. Anyway, the same thing happened when we went to England. Only this time, you know, we were told a few hours before signing the contract that the publisher, again, you know, could not publish it because the board of directors had vetoed the book. So I went to Italy because Italy is a country that's lived with terrorists for 30 years. It was a country ready for a different kind of approach than religious fanaticism. So we sold the book in 12 hours, and the publisher not only paid for my research, but also agreed to translate the book from English to Italian, which is my mother tongue. So now the book has been translated and is coming out in a few months. Anyway, I told you this story because I want you to understand that although you have read in newspapers for 2.5 years about terrorists, although you know, you go on Amazon and there must be 2,000 titles on terrorism, the truth is that this topic has been researched only for a very, very short time, and we have a long way to go. But let me tell you now what was in that proposal in November 2001, so you can understand how the publishers were shocked and could not handle it. What I did in my research, I actually looked at the economics of terrorism. Now, terrorism is a political phenomenon, and as long as it remains in the domain of politics, no worldwide consensus will ever be achieved on what really it is. I mean, what is the difference between a freedom fighter and a terrorist? I mean, if you go to Saudi Arabia today and you ask people, what do you think of Osama bin Laden? They'll tell you he's a hero. He's the guy who actually won the anti-Soviet jihad. If you go to New York and ask the same question, people will tell you he's a terrorist and assassin. So, I mean, this is the limitation of terrorists. It's actually the political perspective. I think today the only decent definition is the one of Chomsky, who said, you know, a terrorist is anybody who is attacking us. And that applies everywhere. So I wanted to avoid this. So I looked at the economics. I looked at how armed organizations actually fund themselves. What do they do with the money? How do they use the money? And I, to a certain extent, ignore the ideology. And this is also because during my interviews with right and left-wing terrorist group, I discovered that they were doing exactly the same thing. As I said initially, they never discuss ideology. They only discuss money. So I retrace the birth and evolution of terrorist organization going back to the end of World War II. Now, modern terrorism is a phenomenon that took shape during the decolonization process. And I discover that armed organizations were able to build an international economic system. And I also discovered three evolutionary stages of this international economic system. The first stage is the state sponsor of terrorism, which was typical of the Cold War. This is when the two superpowers were fighting war by proxy along the periphery of their sphere of influence. And they did that by fully funding armed organization. Now, the best example for North America is the Contras. They were created by the CIA. They were fully funded by the US, either through covert operation or legal funding. But the same we can say for the Soviet Union, who actually was funding various armed organizations in Latin America, for example, the Tupamaros. Now, the strategy used by these two superpowers were very, very similar. The United States used the CIA as a go-between the U.S. administration and the various armed organizations supported by the U.S. The Soviet Union used Cuba in Latin America and offsprings of the PLO in the Middle East. The differences were minimal. The U.S. was always cash generous, of course. The Soviet Union was not, because it was always short of cash. So they preferred to give weapons or free training. But the concept of how these two superpowers acted is exactly the same. Now, the second evolutionary stage took place in the late 1970s, early 80s. And this is what I define as the privatization of terrorism. This is when armed organizations were actually able to become independent from the sponsor by raising money themselves. Now, the best examples is the PLO in the Middle East, the IRA in Northern Ireland and ETA in Spain. These organizations were able to create a system of sustenance that then also a system that generated profits. And therefore, you know, they carried out, you know, their own struggle. They stopped fighting the war by proxy of the very superpower who were backing them. The last stage, which is the most interesting, because it is affecting us today, is what I define as the globalization of terrorism. That took place in the 1990s. With the deregularization of the international financial system, Western capitalism actually spread all over the world. But as Western capitalism spread, so did the economy of terrorism. The armed organizations were able to raise money cross-border. They were also able to become operational in more than one country. Now, the best example, again, is Al-Qaeda, which is not an organization like the Red Brigades, where it's not pyramidal, it's not concentrated in one country, it's not controlled by four or five people. It's actually a global phenomenon. You have sleeper, you have cells, you have offspring all over the world. So we are looking at a new phenomenon, which is much, much more serious than the Red Brigades were. The globalization and the deregularization of the international financial markets also gave the possibility to armed organizations to link up with each other, so do business with each other, but also to do business with the illegal economy and the criminal economy. Now, together today, we're looking at an economy which is generating a turnover of $1.5 trillion. Now, this is twice the GDP of the United Kingdom. I mean, it's a giant, it's an economic giant. Now, I came to this figure working with an expert from the Brookings Institution. His name is Raymond Baker, and he's an expert on money laundering. And we worked together, and you know, this is the figure we came out. But recently, the IMF has actually come out with the same figure, 1.57 trillion. There are other analysts who are trying to calculate this economy, and the statistics range from $1 to $2 trillion, but still massive, massive amount of money. Now, this economy is all denominated in US dollars. If you want to go and buy weapons today in Iraq, you have to pay in US dollars. If you want to money launder money today in the Channel Islands, you have to go with US dollars. And that means this money flows into primarily the US economy. And the US economy is dependent upon this massive amount of cash. If tomorrow George Bush, by a miracle, wins the war on terror, the US economy will go into a deep recession. So this is a brief summary of what this proposal put forward in November 2001 was saying. Now, something like this was shocking for, you know, commercial publishers in the United States. And you can understand why nobody even, you know, wanted to take it into consideration. Now, today the situation is completely different, because today, 2.5 years into this war on terror, with this organization continuing to be extremely active today, everybody's now realizing that this was not a bunch of religious fanatics. There was something else. Anyway, so the book is out, which is great, because in the end, you know, I did get, you know, a publisher who believed in what I wrote, and, you know, we sold the book in translation everywhere. So things are better than they were 2.5 years ago. And I now hope that you have questions about the new economy of terror and about my research. Thank you.
Loretta Napoleoni, author of The Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks.
Okay, I'm going to repeat the question because I don't think you heard it. The question is about the suicide bombers, if they are more motivated by ideology than by money. Yes, you are 100% right. I mean, the suicide bombers are motivated by ideology. These people are not crazy. I mean, none of us will ever give up our life for money. I'm pretty sure of that. And you know, they are exactly the same. But the suicide bomber is actually a very peculiar phenomenon of Islamic terrorism. In fact, it is only a phenomenon of Islamic terrorism. There was never anything like that in modern terrorism. Why this is happening? Because these people have reached a level of despair, of desperation, that there is nothing else to do. And there is where religion gives you hope for a better life. I think the closest analogy that we can find, it is with the Christian martyrs. And it's very interesting when you go and look, the appeal that the word of Christ had at the beginning of Christianity, it was actually appealing to the slaves and to the poor people. It was not appealing to the patricians of Rome. And the same thing is happening today with the suicide bombers. I mean, Hamas recruits predominantly in areas where people have lived as refugees for three generations. There are variations, of course. I mean, what I did in my book, I did a cost-benefit analysis, actually looked at suicide bombers as commodities, because they are commodities. This is how they are defined. I mean, the leaders of Hamas actually said that the difference between Israel and the Palestinians is that Israel has the American missiles and they have the suicide bombers. And it is a weapon in their hands. But what I actually looked at the economics, I didn't look so much about the ideology. The cost of a suicide bomber is according to where the suicide bomber is recruited. They trade suicide bombers. You can actually, you know, trade from one group to another your suicide bombers. In in Palestine, the cost is often just to drive, the cost of transportation, which is very high, of course, because of the securities, but also generally the family is compensated. Now, the money do not come from, predominantly, they do not come from the organization who actually is recruiting the suicide bombers, but they come from donors. Saudi Arabia is one of the largest donors of suicide bombers. But in Chechnya, the cost of suicide bombers is as low as $6 to $10, which is the cost of the explosive. Predominantly, they're women who have nothing left. Their family has been destroyed. You know, they have been raped. They have been, you know, violated by, you know, the Russian armies. And this is the cheapest place to find the suicide bombers. Sad story. The question is to comment on the psychological profiling and recruiting in organizations which are not like the Red Brigades, but organizations like Al-Qaeda, which are, you know, completely different. The psychological profiling still works for these organizations. Of course, because the organization is not concentrated in one single place, what's happened is that the majority of the people today are recruiting for Al-Qaeda or other offsprings of Al-Qaeda around the world are people who, in a way or another, have come close to the leadership of Al-Qaeda. So there were other former Arab Afghans, you know, people who participated in the anti-Soviet jihad in the 1980s in Afghanistan, or there are people who have been trained in the 1990s in the camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So these people, to a certain extent, are being delegated with the task to look at the psychological profiling. A lot of recruitment takes place from the religious schools, which of course is something that organizations like the Red Brigades did not have, although at that time in Italy and in Europe there were various Marxist organizations like social clubs where people would go. So that was also a good recruiting place for the Red Brigades. But the most important recruiting tool is definitely the madrasas, the religious schools, and then the mosque. Yeah. Okay, and then the question is about the ideology. what is, you know, really the role of Osama bin Laden. The ideology, okay, in the case of the Red Brigades, a Marxist or fascist and right-winged organization in Europe in the 1970s, 1980s, the ideology was paramount. So, I mean, people would be indoctrinated, as I said before, they would get into the organization and be indoctrinated and molded to whatever it was, the ideology of the group. In the case of the Islamic terror, something very similar happens, but often this doesn't take place within the organization, but it takes place either in the madrasas or in the mosque. So by the time they actually get into the organization, they're already ready to be operational. Osama bin Laden is a charismatic leader, is very much the, I would say, you know, the equivalent of, you know, Stalin or Lenin or anybody that had, you know, that kind of ideological status. One of the danger of killing Osama bin Laden is actually to turn him into an icon much, much bigger than what he is today. And yes, he is the most important. There is nobody else at that level in the world. Okay. The question is about the importance that unemployment plays for recruitment of Islamic terrorist organization, and what is also the concept of the shell state. Let me start with the concept of the shell state, because that's very central to my book. When I was talking about the privatization of terrorism, I was mentioning the PLO. Now, the way the PLO actually managed to become independent is by creating what I define as shell state. Now, a shell state is a state who only has the outside of a state, the socio-economic infrastructure of a state, but it lacks the core of the state, which is the national identity. In the case of the PLO, the PLO, when it was in Lebanon, it actually managed to control the entire economy of Lebanon. And this is the primary reason why Israel invaded Lebanon. The reason why the shell state is so successful is because it actually takes shape in highly destabilized political areas. A good example of shell states now taking place is actually Iraq. By destabilizing the political situation in Iraq, we're now seeing Islamic groups moving into various areas and gaining control of these areas. Now, a shell state can be as small as a section of a town. I mean, during the civil war in Lebanon, the Christian militia controlled East Lebanon, which was the enclave where the Christians lived. And he basically ran that enclave like a state. I mean, it was in charge of taxation and cleaning the streets. So that's quite dangerous, because these shell states, what they do, they basically destroy the socio-economic infrastructure of the regions or areas that they control militarily. Again, Iraq is a good example. Lots of people have asked, why are they attacking the Red Cross, and why are they attacking the UN delegation? Now, that was not the first time that something like this happened. It happened in Chechnya, it happened in Africa, it happened in Bosnia. It's part of their strategy. By destroying the socio-economic infrastructure of the areas they control, they force the population to become dependent upon their economy. So one way or another, the population is drawn to the armed organization. That doesn't mean that they have to join the armed organization. They actually start working for the infrastructure around the armed organization. So the shell state, of course, is attractive to unemployed people. In my book, I talk about the Central Asian republics. There is a region called the Fergana Valley, which is should be an extremely fertile region, but is a region with 80% unemployment. That's one of the best ground for recruitment for Islamic terrorist groups. They have nothing else. I mean, that's the only way that they can actually feed themselves, feed their family, and even, you know, have a vision of a better life in the long term. Sorry, I can't hear you. Did you say the shell state? The CIA being placed into the shell state category, are you talking about the funding during the state sponsor of terrorism, yes, the CIA use techniques which are very similar in order to create an economic situation whereby the local population actually to support the armed organization that they were backing. Now, the Contras is a very good example in Honduras and in Guatemala because, you know, the spreading actually of the Contras in the neighboring countries of Nicaragua created economic decay in these regions, and people were forced, yes, you're right. Okay, the question is that the dependency of the American economy upon this terror economy is so big that basically we are interconnected. The problem is, you don't have to think that this was created by Western capitalism. This is something that happened because Western capitalism was so greedy that decided to knock down barriers without thinking about the consequences of these barriers coming down. I mean, offshore banking is fantastic for Western capitalism, but it's also very good for anybody that wants to move money around without being phoned. And this is what these guys are doing. From the point of view of the U.S. economy, it is true that the U.S. economy is actually benefiting. And I can explain, you know, in economic terms, that it's benefiting from this economy. Now, what I do not think that this administration has realized yet is that, and that includes also the Fed and Greenspan, is that this economy is not only illegal and criminal economy, it's also a terror economy. But if you look at the U.S. money supply, M1, which is cash and ready deposit, since the 1960s, there has been a trend in the U.S. money supply whereby more and more money which are produced, the new stock of dollars which is produced every year, leaves the United States and never comes back. Now, there have been a lot of economists who have written about that, including people from the Federal Reserve of St. Louis, saying this is a serious problem. Where are this money going? This money are going to feed the illegal economy. Now, nothing has been done. Now, today, the total amount of M1 is $500 billion. Of this $500 billion, two-thirds leaves the United States and never comes back. These are money that leave in suitcases, they live through offshore banking. These are not money they are actually leaving because they go into the reserves of foreign banks. Now, these are money that actually go and feed the international illegal economy, which is, as I said before, denominated in US dollar. Now, for the United States, is a net saving because, of course, the Treasury every year can borrow against a U.S. money supply, which is $500 billion. The truth is that the amount of the money supply in the U.S. is only one-third. So now this can happen only because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world, so it has a special status. But nevertheless, the Americans are actually borrowing money every year thanks to the growth of the illegal and terror economy. I know what you know. But I mean, there are a lot of conspiracy theories. I'm so sorry, shall I repeat the question? The question is the links between Osama bin Laden and the CIA. Actually, Osama bin Laden is a creation of the CIA, and that the Bush administration did not do anything or even stopped the investigation on Al-Qaeda. Okay, let me answer. You can sit down now. I'll answer this. I did this research, and I never came across anything that links directly the CIA to Osama bin Laden. Now, the CIA, together with the Saudi They funded the anti-Soviet jihad. They set up the Afghan pipeline, which was a system through which cash and weapons went to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan who were fighting the Soviets. There was $5 billion going through that pipeline, and very little of those $5 billion reached the Mujahideen because it was widespread bribery, stealing by everybody along that pipeline, including... you can sit down. I have to finish. Yes, okay. Now, what Osama bin Laden did at that time while he was in Afghanistan was actually to set up an alternative system of funding for the Mujahideen because of this problem with the Afghan pipeline. So this is when the charities became particularly active, because he actually used funding from donation, primarily from Saudi Arabia, in order to fund the Mujahideen. Now, according to my research, Osama bin Laden was never trained by the CIA. In fact, Osama bin Laden was never trained at all, because he's not a fighter. He was actually somebody who was looking after the financial side of the Mujahideen. Let me finish. And then, it is true that the FBI, before 9/11, was investigating a charity called WAMI. Now, WAMI was a charity that was run in the United States by two brothers of Osama bin Laden. It's an incredibly rich charity from Saudi Arabia. It's called the World Assembly of Muslim Youth. It's active in 35 countries. It has been put on trial in the Philippines and in India in the late 1990s, and this is why the FBI started investigating it here. Now, the Clinton administration told the FBI to go slowly on that investigation because of the links between this organization and key figures in Saudi Arabia. When Bush came to power, he actually told the FBI to back off. So that investigation was never actually completed. So it is true that there was no interest in investigating certain situations, in particular funding of Islamic terrorist groups before 9/11. But this is because this was a phenomenon that did not affect the United States directly, as I said before in my speech. But if you ask me about conspiracy theory, I do not believe them. Well, no, excuse me. Excuse me. There are other people. This is a public. It's a public. You had your chance. Please. I have absolutely no documentation in my hands that Osama bin Laden is a CIA agent. So if you do have documents, I'll be very happy to look at them. Yeah, the question is about small arms. Now, small arms are different from conventional arms. They're generally arms that are used in guerrilla warfare. The shoulder missiles, for example, which they're using now in Iraq, to knock down helicopters, is considered a small arm. Missiles, on the other hand, and tanks, is conventional arms. Now, the armed organization only buys small arms. I mean, first of all, because they have no access to conventional arms. Conventional arms are sold by states. The United States is the largest producer of both conventional arms and small arms. And the majority, actually, of the weapons which are bought illegally by armed organization or mafia organization and organized crimes comes from the United States. Canada does participate in this export. So does France. But the second largest producer of small arms is Russia. Africa and Southeast Asia is actually predominantly supplied by Russia. I mean, if you want me to comment on the moral argument, I can't because I'm an economist. But the truth is that this is a world where everything is sold and everything can be bought. And this is not different from the world 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. What can the citizens of Canada do about this involvement, and well, there is a lot that people can actually do to convince the politicians to pass legislation to prevent the sales of these arms. You want figures about how much money are going into the reconstruction in Iraq? No, I don't have the figures because there is no reconstruction yet. The $87 billion additional budget, which has been voted by Congress, is going totally to sustain the war in one way or another. But what is more shocking is that 30% of that budget, sorry, more than 30%, actually, $13 billion of that budget is actually going to the private military industry. Now, there are 10,000 mercenaries in Iraq from the United States. The second largest contingency of the coalition forces are mercenaries. The British are only 9,000. So the U.S. military industry has been privatized in the last 10 years. There's very little that the U.S. government is still, you know, supplying directly, apart from training of soldiers, from the shoes to the tanks. Everything comes from the private industry. So I think that's even more interesting than the reconstruction, because, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, who is actually getting the money for this reconstruction, which, again, has not been taken place yet. I mean, there are various bids and various decisions have been taken, but, you know, nobody's actually started rebuilding schools yet. But more interesting, I think, is the fact that the private industry, which is the U.S. private industry, is actually sustaining the actual war. I mean, it's not the U.S. military, but it's the mercenaries of the U.S. I think that's very serious. The question is about the BCCI. The BCCI actually was a Pakistani registered bank, but it was fully funded by the Saudis. It was the largest international bank from the Third World, and when it fell, it was a major, major financial scandal. I have it in my book, actually, there's a chapter about the Islamic financial colonization, and that describes the birth of Islamic banks. Now, Islamic banks were actually created in the late 1970s. After the first oil shock, there was a massive amount of money which flew from West to oil-producing countries, in particular in Saudi Arabia. I mean, a lot of this money came back to the West, to the so-called recycling of petrodollars. Basically, Western banks went to the Saudis and said, I can invest your money in the West, which is better than keeping there in the middle of the desert. So the money actually came back. But a lot of money stayed in Saudi Arabia. They were invested in Saudi Arabia and created the economic boom of Saudi Arabia. Now, a group of bankers from Saudi Arabia, some of them linked to the Bin Laden family. In fact, one, Bin Malfous, is one of Bin Laden's brother-in-law. They decided to set up Islamic banks. Now, for Islamic religion, the interest rate is actually a sin. You're not supposed to charge money for money. Basically, it is usury. So therefore, they were quite concerned about the presence of Western banks in their country. And this dates back to the 1960s, actually, even 50s in Egypt. So they used this money that were coming from the recycling of petrodollar to set up these banks. The actual structure of the Islamic bank was written by the clerics, by the Wahhabis. So the Islamic banks, for example, incorporate the zakat, which is the religious almsgiving that every single Muslim has to give. And it's equivalent 2.5% of its wealth. So every single time that a transaction takes place and somebody makes money, the bank will levy the zakat. Now, the first most successful Islamic bank was BCCI. And BCCI then became a sort of flag for all the other banks. Now, BCCI was incredibly well connected. It was the bank used by the CIA to funnel money through the Afghan pipeline during the anti-Soviet jihad. It's a bank that's been used by George W. Bush several times for his Arbusto Company and Arkin Company, for example. So we're talking about an extremely well-connected bank. And now, it was also a bank run by a bunch of crooks, of course. And this is why eventually it collapsed. But the important thing is that the BCCI, it is the blueprint of Islamic banks today, actually used by Islamic terrorist groups in order to move money from one place to another. And that's very important because the difference between a terrorist organization and a criminal organization is that the criminal organization ultimate goal is accumulation of wealth. The ultimate goal of a terrorist organization is not the accumulation, but the distribution of wealth. How are you going to move money from one country to another country? How are you going to move money from one cell to another cell? And this is where Islamic banks actually play a very important role. The question is, the U.S. administration is interested in stopping the funneling of money. Yes, the U.S. administration is interested in stopping the funneling of money, but it can't do anything because the money are not in the West. The majority of the money are actually in the Muslim world, and we have no jurisdiction that over there. Now, the UN has just produced a document which came out at the beginning of December. In this document, the UN says that so far only $125 million have been frozen of terror money, which is absolutely nothing. Of this 125 million, only 54 million are money that went directly to Al-Qaeda. Now, the 70% of this money has been frozen in the West. 30% has been frozen in the East. The reason why we cannot get into this money is because we have no jurisdiction over the countries where actually the money are generated. And I think this is a very serious problem because that means that the U.S. administration is relying more and more on its allies. And we're talking about Saudi Arabia, for example. And Saudi Arabia is in a very dangerous position because he can go after the money of Islamic group, he can go after his own charities because the ruling elite is already extremely unpopular. So he has to balance between, you know, the American allies and its own internal social unrest. Okay, the question is about, you know, how the U.S. was it was funding a terrorist network, some example. The U.S. was heavily involved during the Cold War in state-sponsored terrorism, funding groups to fight war by proxy. That doesn't mean that today the U.S. is not involved. I mean, a good example is Sudan. Actually, the U.S. is supporting the SPLA, which is a group which has occupied the southern part of Sudan. It's considered to be a sort of Christian group, but the truth is it is a terrorist group. I mean, the U.S. is funding them not only with cash but also with weapons. Now, the reason why it's doing that is because the northern part of Sudan is under the control of a government which is, you know, pro-Islamist, although it's much less militant than it was before. So in a certain way, we're looking at another war by proxy. That's what generally the U.S. does. Okay, the IRA has always been considered the best organization for explosive. I mean, they are incredibly skilled to create bombs that will explode at the right time and in the right place. I mean, the bombing in Brighton of the hotel where Mrs. Thatcher was staying, the IRA actually put that bomb a month before, and they put the bomb underneath the bathtub and they program it with the video recorder. They are amazing. So they have been training people on explosive all over the world. They don't do it for ideological reasons. They actually do it for money, to fund their struggle. So when this happened in Colombia, which is last year, the IRA officially was not operational anymore. However, the IRA has been funding the transition from a terrorist organization to a political organization, which Sinn Féin, through the same activities, illegal activities, that they have been selling for years. And this is a good example of how difficult is actually the transition from the illegal economy into the legal economy, because this organization has been run in a certain way for a very long time, and they don't know any other way to raise money. So, okay, the question is about the drug trade and how this drug trade is linked to the terror economy. In my calculation, the new economy of terror, which is the international economic system generated by armed organization activities, is equivalent to $500 billion. Of this $500 billion, one-third is legal activities, and the remaining is illegal activities. Of this, the largest entry is actually coming from drugs. Now, the total amount of drug trade around the world, illegal drugs, of course, we're talking, is $500 billion. This includes, of course, the amount of money that the mafia or that criminal organization gets. But I would say that easily $300 billion is actually what the terror organization gets. There are two major areas where illegal drugs are produced. One is Central Asia. Afghanistan produces 80% of the opium of the entire world. And the other area is South America. Now, in South America, we see the FARC, which is the former Marxist terrorist group, now has become a sort of militia for the narco-traffickers. We also see Sendero Luminoso, the other Marxist terrorist group from Peru, is actually overlooking the production of coca in Peru and also being in charge of selling it to the various drug dealers that then, you know, sell it to North America. So they get a very large percentage of that business. And if you look at the drug route, the majority of the passages from, you know, one country to another is handled by terrorist organization. The only time where you get the mafia involved is actually when the drugs arrive almost at the gate of Europe, which is Turkey. And then from Turkey onwards, you have a mixture of terror organization and mafia. So this is why I said that of these 400 billions, about 300 is actually goes into the new economy of terror. Well, Enron was not involved with drug laundering of money. I mean, you know, I don't think, I didn't come across Enron in my research, sorry. Yeah, okay, but I can only comment on what I research. I'm a human being and I have limitations. The only forecast I did, if two-thirds of the U.S. money supply actually goes into this economy as new stock of cash every year, that means that this economy is growing twice as fast as the U.S. economy. And that's quite scary. Yeah, the money supply is that every year the Fed produces new stock of dollars, okay? This new stock of dollars is based upon the need of the economy. The need of the economy, and this country, for example, every year produces a new stock of Canadian dollars. I don't know the exact figure, but those Canadian dollars are used by every single Canadian in this country in order to buy things, right? So in the case of the United States, that figure should not be 500 billions. It should be only one-third of those 500 billions. And what is happening is that the U.S. is also feeding another economy.
Loretta Napoleoni, author of The Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks.